They got very soon to the Chinese pictographs, ideograms, and phonograms, and beyond them. Most people know a sort of puzzle called a rebus. It's a way of representing words by pictures, not of the things the words represent, but by the pictures of other things having a similar sound. For example, two gates and a head is a rebus for Gates' head, a little streamlet, beck, a crowned monarch, and a ham, becking ham. The Sumerian language was a language well adapted to this sort of representation. It was apparently a language of often quite vast polysyllables, made up of very distinct inalterable syllables, and many of the syllables taken separately were the names of concrete things, so that this cuneiform writing developed very readily into a syllable way of writing in which each sign conveys a syllable, just as each act in a charade conveys a syllable. When presently the Semites conquered Sumeria, they adapted the syllabic system to their own speech, and so this writing became entirely a sign-for-a-sound writing. It was so used by the Assyrians and by the Chaldeans. But it wasn't a letter writing. It was a syllable writing. This cuneiform script prevailed for long ages over Assyria, Babylonia, and the Near East generally. There are vestiges of it in some of the letters of our alphabet today. Third. But, meanwhile, in Egypt and upon the Mediterranean coast, yet another system of writing grew up. Its beginnings are probably to be found in the priestly picture writing, hieroglyphics, of the Egyptians, which also, in the usual way, became partly a sound sign system. As we see it on the Egyptian monuments, the hieroglyphic writing consists of decorative but stiff and elaborate forms. But for such purposes as letter writing and the keeping of recipes and the like, the Egyptian priests used a much simplified and flowing form of these characters, the hieratic script. Side by side with this hieratic script rose another, probably also derivative from the hieroglyphs, a script now lost to use, which was taken over by various non-Egyptian peoples in the Mediterranean, the Phoenicians, Libyans, Lydians, Cretans, and Celt-Iberians, and used for business purposes. Possibly a few letters were borrowed from the later cuneiform. In the hands of these foreigners, this writing was, so to speak, cut off from its roots. It lost all but a few traces of its early pictorial character. It ceased to be pictographic or ideographic. It became simply a pure sound sign system, an alphabet. There were a number of such alphabets in the Mediterranean, differing widely from each other. It may be noted that the Phoenician alphabet, and perhaps others, omitted vowels. Possibly they pronounced their consonants very hard, and had rather indeterminate vowels, as it's said to be still the case with tribes of South Arabia. Quite probably, too, the Phoenicians used their alphabet at first not so much for writing as for single initial letters in their business accounts and tallies. One of these Mediterranean alphabets reached the Greeks long after the time of the Iliad, who presently set to work to make it express the clear and beautiful sounds of their own highly developed Aryan speech. It consisted at first of consonants, and the Greeks added the vowels. They began to write for record, to help and fix their bardic tradition. Fourth. So it was, by a series of very natural steps, that writing grew out of the life of man. At first, and for long ages, it was the interest and the secret of only a few people in a special class, a mere accessory to the record of pictures. But there were certain very manifest advantages, quite apart from the increased expressiveness of mood and qualification, to be gained by making writing a little less plain than straightforward pictures, and in conventionalizing and codifying it. One of these was that so messages might be sent understandable by the sender and receiver, but not plain to the uninitiated. Another was that so one might put down various matters and help one's memory and the memory of one's friends without giving away too much to the common herd. Among some of the earliest Egyptian writings, for example, are medical recipes and magic formulae. Accounts, letters, recipes, name lists, itineraries, these were the earliest of written documents. Then, as the art of writing and reading spread, came that odd desire, that pathetic desire, so common among human beings, to astonish some strange and remote person by writing down something striking, some secret one knew, some strange thought, or even one's name, so that long after one had gone one's way, it might strike upon the sight and mind of another reader. Even in Sumeria, men scratched on walls, and all that remains to us of the ancient world, its rocks, its buildings, is plastered thickly with the names and the boasting of those foremost among human advertisers, its kings. Perhaps half the early inscriptions in that ancient world are of this nature, if, that is, we group with the name-writing and boasting the epitaphs, which were probably in many cases prearranged by the deceased. For long the desire for crude self-assertion of the name-scrawling sort and the love of secret understandings kept writing within a narrow scope. But that other, more truly social desire in men, the desire to tell, was also at work. The profounder possibilities of writing, the possibilities of a vast extension and definition and settlement of knowledge and tradition, only grew apparent after long ages. But it'll be interesting at this point, and in this connection, to recapitulate certain elemental facts about life, upon which we laid stress in our earlier chapters, because they illuminate not only the huge value of writing in the whole field of man's history, but also the role it's likely to play in his future. First, life had at first, it must be remembered, only a discontinuous repetition of consciousness, as the old died and the young were born. Such a creature as a reptile has in its brain a capacity for experience, but when the individual dies, its experience dies with it. Most of its motives are purely instinctive, and all the mental life that it has is the result of heredity, birth inheritance. Second, but ordinary mammals have added to pure instinct tradition, a tradition of experience imparted by the imitated example of the mother, and in the case of such mentally developed animals as dogs, cats, or apes, by a sort of mute precept also. For example, the mother cat chastises her young for misbehavior. So do mother apes and baboons. Third, primitive man added to his powers of transmitting experience representative art and speech. Pictorial and sculptured record and verbal tradition began. Verbal tradition was developed to its highest possibility by the bards. They did much to make language what it is to the world today. Fourth, with the invention of writing, which developed out of pictorial record, human tradition was able to become fuller and much more exact. Verbal tradition, which had hitherto changed from age to age, began to be fixed. Men separated by hundreds of miles could now communicate their thoughts. An increasing number of human beings began to share a common written knowledge and a common sense of a past and a future. Human thinking became a larger operation in which hundreds of minds in different places and in different ages could react upon one another. It became a process constantly more continuous and sustained. And so on. Fifth, for hundreds of generations, the full power of writing wasn't revealed to the world because for a long time the idea of multiplying writings by taking prints of a first copy didn't become effective. The only way of multiplying writings was by copying one copy at a time, and this made books costly and rare. Moreover, the tendency to keep things secret, to make a cult and mystery of them, and so to gain an advantage over the generality of men, has always been very strong in men's minds. It's only nowadays that the great masses of mankind are learning to read, and reaching out towards the treasures of knowledge and thought already stored in books. Nevertheless, from the first writings onward, a new sort of tradition, an enduring and immortal tradition, began in the minds of men. Life, through mankind, grew thereafter more and more distinctly conscious of itself and its world. It's a thin streak of intellectual growth we trace in history. At first, in a world of tumultuous ignorance and forgetfulness, it's like a mere line of light coming through the chink of an opening door into a darkened room. But slowly it widens, it grows. At last came a time in the history of Europe when the door, at the push of the printer, began to open more rapidly. Knowledge flared up, and as it flared, it ceased to be the privilege of a favored minority. For us now, that door swings wider, and the light behind grows brighter. Misty it is still, glowing through clouds of dust and reek. The door is not half open. The light is but a light new lit. Our world today is only in the beginning of knowledge.